Well, thank you, Greg and team. And Greg, I love the two keyboards there today. So when I think about being a church of a multiplying disciple-making movement, I got to admit, I wasn't thinking about multiplying the keyboard players in the band, but I'm glad you thought of that, which is just awesome. And looking forward to our fall journey together, friends, and all that God has for us. Steve mentioned around the Everybody's In flyer that you got as you came in. So if you can fill that in now, we want everyone to fill it in. You're already involved in a ministry somewhere. Let's say you volunteer at the community dinner once a month kind of thing. Just check that box, stick your name on there. Or if you're interested, okay, you saw Chris's video and you're like, okay, maybe just I want to have a conversation. Don't take this home and stick it in your back pocket because you know what's going to happen, right? Next Saturday when you do the laundry, you're going to think, ah, I should have checked my pockets before I did that. So fill it in now and then hand it in at the Welcome Center in your leaving. And if you got questions on this, you can speak to any of us. And like I said, I'd like everybody to fill it in because we want to see who's involved where and how many are involved. Yesterday, I was reading about the percentage of congregants in North America who are involved in their church, and I want to compare us to the rest of the church, you know. And so, fill this in, and we look forward serving together, whether it's here in the building or outside of the building, you know. Looking forward, you know, there's things that are going on. I know Steve and May, you're doing a walk on Saturday afternoon, right? Our walking group is going. Some of us from the biking group are going biking Saturday morning in Richmond for the Ratneck Ride, you know. And so whether outside of the church, inside of the church, that together we're following Christ as we move forward this fall. And we're going to launch a new sermon series today, What Your Soul Needs. And I'm excited about this series because we as a church care about the soul. And there's an existential angst within humans that isn't true in animals, let's say. For example, we have a dog, Cheerio. Cheerio is 16 years old, which is pretty old, right? That's like 90 or 100, you know, in human years. But Cheerio never says to herself, did I live the life that the Creator wanted me to live? You know? She never asks herself those kind of questions, you know? Is there any unfinished business that I have to do before I leave this earth? But as humans, we're unique in asking ourselves questions around meaning and purpose. In fact, I would suggest that we crave this. We want to know, why am I here on this earth? And we here in Metro Vancouver aren't unique in asking that question. In fact, when they do surveys across the globe, they find that about 75% of people regularly ask themselves questions around their meaning. And the variations among regions are minimal, whether it's in North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, everyone is asking themselves the same question. And we will continue to ask ourselves this question. As a species, we have made incredible progress. Compare our time period now that you and I are living in to our ancestors and how much advancements have been made in terms of travel, communication, accomplishments, healthcare, you name it. Think about how much wealthier and more comfortable we are than our ancestors. Yet we struggle, perhaps more than any other time period in history, with happiness. We struggle more than our forefathers and foremothers. We have higher rates of depression and suicide. Isn't it telling that we've made so much progress and yet there's so much unhappiness? We seek purpose. We seek a cause beyond ourselves. We can have family. We can have a good job, healthy relationships. We can have religion, and yet we still seek higher purpose. We seek it, and yet it seems so elusive. When we're young, we anticipate it, and then we wonder, are we ever going to find it? It always seems around the corner. Sometimes we get cynical. We blame ourselves or blame others. We fear living a meaningless life. Sometimes we pursue success, but the status, the material goods, the travel, the accomplishments, they may give us a temporary spike in pleasure, But again, that spike drops off, and we ask ourselves questions around meaning. Viktor Frankl, in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, suggests that we need a transcendent reference, that we can't just look within ourselves. To discover meaning, we've got to go beyond our inner feelings, our inner interpretation. We need to look to an external source beyond ourselves, that we need to look to our souls. And that's what we're going to talk about this fall, what your soul needs. This past Thursday at men's breakfast, 7 a.m. at Cora's, and you're welcome, guys, to join us if you're free then. Somebody asked the question, what are you looking forward to? And I said, I'm looking forward to a better year. Because last year, by May, June, I kind of felt like a football player who's got the football and the end zone is there, and I wasn't sure if I was going to make the end zone. Wasn't sure if I was going to drop the ball. Wasn't sure if I was going to get tackled. I didn't know if I was going to make it. In fact, I said to Sheila one evening, I don't know if I'm going to make it. Some of you can perhaps can relate. I shared this summer that metaphor of the football player with somebody who I kind of admire, you know, and you think on the outward seems very successful. And he said, I can relate to that. He said, I often feel like I'm not going to make it. So friends, what does it take for you and I to have healthy souls? See, because if we don't, that's going to show up in external ways, right? It's going to show up in some of our attitudes, our behaviors, whatever. Like, for example, me in June. Like I said, I'm kind of stumbling towards the end zone. I leave the church here one Sunday evening after community dinner. I drive out of the parking lot, come to the corner here, and I see an ambulance there at the bus stop together with a number of our Sunday evening congregants. What do? I drove by. I just kept driving. You say, what kind of a terrible, heartless pastor would drive by? I say, a pastor whose soul is shriveling. And I can justify it, right? I can say, hey, work all week. I preach Sunday morning, preach that Sunday evening, whatever. But that night, I just felt like S-H-I-T, like, who does that? Friends, when our souls are unhealthy, it shows up in all sorts of behaviors. And maybe you can relate to a soul weariness. And we as a church community want to talk about soul care this fall. It's been an expression running through my head these last couple weeks. Churched but not changed. And I'm not sure if I heard it somewhere or just kind of made it up in my head, but that we can go to church but not necessarily be changed, right? We can go Sunday after Sunday, week after week, year after year, decade after decade, and yet not necessarily be transformed. We want to be that transforming church. And it happens at our soul level, the deepest level, when we hear God speaking to us, deep calling to deep. We all have souls. We know it because sometimes they hurt. But it's difficult to see our souls, right? We know that when there's a, let's say, a dent in our car, we can see that. We know how to fix that. But a dent in our souls, how do you cover that? Well, you can kind of mask it. But no amount of extracurricular activity is going to heal that internal hurt. Souls. What is the soul? Is it just a part of our life that continues on after we die? Well, I would suggest that it's far more than that. That the soul, your soul, is the most important part of your life. It's continually running, kind of like a computer program in the background. That's what makes this series so crucial. Soul. The Hebrew word in the Bible is nephesh. It's repeatedly used in the Bible to describe a longing or desiring or a striving. Sometimes that word nephesh is translated as throat to refer to our thirst. Let's take a look, Psalm 42. Why don't we stick it up on the screen there? Let's read it together. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with God? There's that word nephesh used a couple times there. This thirsting, this soul longing that we have. And this brings us to the paradox of the souls. Our souls are striving for satisfaction, but they're incapable of satisfying themselves. The soul can't satisfy itself, but it seeks satisfaction. Our souls long to be loved, to be significant, but we can't do this on our own. How do we find it? Well, let's do a quick journey through the first two chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes, and we'll see a man who is on this soul satisfaction quest. And perhaps you can relate to one of the seven ways that he was trying to satisfy his soul. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. So the word teacher there that's used is the Hebrew word koheleth. That could refer to somebody's name, that koheleth wrote this book, or it gets translated as teacher or preacher. Now, the Christian church has traditionally believed that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. And as we'll see, that could very well be true, because on the pursuits he goes on and being the wisest and wealthiest man of his time period, he could have easily accomplished that. So let's go with Solomon being the author. He writes, verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. Wow, there's a guy who got up on the wrong side of the bed that morning. Or some of the translations say, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Or the Message paraphrases it as, smoke, smoke, it's all smoke. 38 times he uses that Hebrew word hevel in his book. And it means breath, vapor, puff of smoke, or a cloud of steam. I read Warren Wiersbe's commentary here on Ecclesiastes 1 this week, and he says one of his professors at seminary defined hevel as whatever is left when the soap bubble breaks. So here in the opening chapters, the teacher outlines that a lot of his pursuits are like what's left from that soap bubble. It's the temporal values of meaningless pursuits that we think will satisfy us, but in the end, they don't. They don't meet us at the soul level. Let's walk through the seven ways. First one he mentions is health and longevity. Verse 4. Generations come and go, and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Verse 11. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. So we live a certain length of years. We live 60, 80, 100, whatever it may be. But in the end, we die and the world goes on. When we have good health, we tend not to think about our health. When we have bad health, we're always thinking about our health. But Solomon reminds us here that our health, our longevity, is just temporary. That the things in this world, the trees, the oceans, the mountains, they were here before us, and they will be here after us. Pinning our hopes on longevity isn't the key to a satisfied life. Or secondly, he mentions education as a second path. Now, Solomon was renowned for his wisdom. No one was smarter in the ancient world in 10th century BC. He was purposeful in pursuing education. And yet, what does he say? Verse 13. I applied my mind to study, to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. verse 16. I said to myself, look, I've increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I've learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. It's not that education and wisdom are bad things, but again, they don't satisfy our soul. They're not an end in of themselves as much as a means to an end. The core of your soul needs more. The third thing that he pursues is pleasure. Solomon was the richest person on the face of the earth at the time. He could pursue pleasure with great gusto. Listen to him, chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. So he's trying to cheer himself up here with wine. Not a bottle of wine, but a barrel of wine. You know, he's got this never-ending kind of college frat party, the hedonistic lifestyle. But he realized that is not an anesthetic for his soul. That he could pursue it, and we read about it in Kings and Chronicles. I mean, the banquet hall that he had, eating the choicest of food, the entertainment that he would bring in. But when the party was over and King Solomon examined his heart, it was still dissatisfied. It was still empty. It was still vanity. It was still the soap bubble bursting and nothing being left behind. Now, instead of wine that he mentions here, we could substitute something else, another drug of choice. Could be drugs, could be gambling, could be sex, could be money, exercise, food, fame, any other pursuit. But the principle still holds true. When pleasure is the center of life, the result will be disappointment and emptiness. Then he pursues work and accomplishments. Now, this never-ending pursuit of alcohol, we would call an alcoholic. The never-ending pursuit of work would be a workaholic. Again, there's nothing wrong with work, but to find one's meaning and purpose in one's work will leave one empty. Listen again to the teacher here, verse 4. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. So he not only built a house, he built houses, plural. He made man-made lakes. In fact, you know, we can read again in Kings and Chronicles about him building cities. And he took on, you know, perhaps one of the greatest building projects of the ancient world in terms of building the temple. He had over 30,000 slaves working on his building projects. Yet these amazing projects didn't bring him inner satisfaction. Another thing he pursued was wealth. It's easy to become obsessed with possessions, material gain. What does the teacher say? Let me keep reading, verse 7. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. So back in Solomon's day, how did you measure wealth? Well, you measured wealth in a number of ways, by how many slaves you had. And he had this vast number of slaves. How many cattle you had or sheep you had. So again, he had these vast flocks of animals. He had storehouses of gold and silver. He had so much. He was known as the wisest and wealthiest man in the ancient Near Eastern world. In fact, there's a myth there, you know. We save up money to go to a concert, right? We try and, you know, if you're going to a Taylor Swift concert, if you can get tickets, you got to save up a lot of money. But what does Solomon do? He buys the band. Eh? That's what I read there, right? He buys the band. He brings them into the palace to do, you know, on-demand performances for him and others, you know. And yet with all his wealth, it didn't bring satisfaction, nor does it for us. Homer Simpson in The Simpsons says to Mr. Burns, "You're the richest man I know." To which he replies, "Yes, but I'd trade it all for more." The pursuit of wealth doesn't bring satisfaction. Now, the Bible is not against wealth, but it's against putting our hope in it. As 1 Timothy 6:17 says, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment." A writer in the Wall Street Journal said about money, "It's an article which may be used as a universal passport to everywhere except heaven and as a universal provider of everything except happiness." Material wealth, like the other pursuits, is fleeting. It's temporary. It can leave our souls parched if we bank on it to bring us satisfaction. The sixth path he pursues is illicit sex. I read the verse earlier. "I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delight of a man's heart." Now we can read in 1 Kings 11 about, you know, his harem. And the raw statistics are there. 700 wives, 300 concubines, you know, more sexual partners, you know, than 3 years for him. And yet it didn't bring him happiness. Today we can get caught up in sexuality as a means to happiness, right? We think that, oh, I'll find Mr. Right or Mrs. Right, and that will make me happy. But again, you think through that. You're putting the pressure on someone else to bring you satisfaction. Only God can provide that level of soul satisfaction, that God-shaped void. Even with all his sexual pursuits, Solomon writes, "Vanity is vanity, all is vanity." Seventh path of dissatisfaction for him was fame. Verse 9. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me." Wow. That's quite the fame, you know? He lived the lifestyle of the rich and the famous. And he was the most famous. He was perhaps the most envied person in the ancient world. And yet, what's his conclusion? Why don't we stick it up on the screen there? "I have seen all things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Here he goes on this quest, looking for satisfaction, for meaning, for purpose. And it's a broad quest. He uses that expression, under the sun. There's an expression he repeats again and again in this book, this idea like, "I searched everywhere, and yet it was meaningless, vanity." He looked for it. In health, education, pleasure, work accomplishments, wealth, illicit sex, fame, and he calls these seven pursuits vanity or meaningless. He could perhaps sing with Bono, "I still haven't found what I'm looking for." Nothing could fill that void in his life, that it was elusive. You know that feeling? That we search for it. Sometimes we don't think about it, but other times we think about it, right? Like I was at a funeral this week, and, you know, after the funeral, I'm thinking, huh, what is my legacy? What do I want to leave behind in terms of meaning and purpose? Because nobody in their dying days when they're, you know, surrounded by IV poles and healthcare monitors. No one who's staring the finish line of their life says, "Hey, bring me the financial records of the company. I want to pore over those one last time." No one says, "Hey, bring me the trophy when I got Volunteer of the Year award. I want to look at that in my dying days." No one says, "Hey, bring me my car by. You know, wash it, get it detailed, and I want to look out the window of the hospice here, you know, to gaze upon my car in my dying days." No one says, "Hey, go to the bank and take out the money, stick it in a briefcase and place it on my chest. And as I exhale my last breath, my finances will be there." We all know in the end what truly matters. And so did Solomon. And in this depressing book that he keeps mentioning about vanity and meaninglessness, this pursuit he goes on. He does reach a conclusion in the last chapter. Why don't we stick it up on the screen? That's the whole story. Here now is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey his commands, for this is everyone's duty. His conclusion was that these seven pursuits were all meaningless, vanity, the leftover of the bubble breaking, that only God could satisfy his soul. But the challenge for us, like Solomon, is we can be easily satisfied temporarily in these other pursuits. Perhaps you can relate to one of the seven pursuits that he was going after, or something else. Maybe it's your house, sports, your fitness, eating, even healthy eating, online gaming, social networking, finding your identity in your kids, investing, a hobby. I could go on and on. I think the question we need to ask ourselves is, will this blank, whatever it may be, bring satisfaction? I say to you today, based on Solomon's journey here, that nothing outside of God can fill in that blank, that everything else is an idol. What is an idol? An idol is anything that takes the place of God. An idol is something that your soul is devoted to more than God. And our souls are easily seduced by substitutes. And if our soul is consumed by anything other than God, we will not be satisfied. Our soul is the deepest part of ourselves. The desperate part of our soul is a longing, not for education or pleasure or acquisition, but just depth to encounter God. John Ortberg suggests that that's the reason the biblical writers, when they speak of the soul, that they will often speak of it in the third person, that they don't speak of like the body or the mind in the same way that they do of the soul, because they're talking about a depth that even we can't put words to. So what does that look like for you, friends? To nurture your soul. To take care of the interior of your life before the external. Because if we don't, our souls will shrivel up. It may even happen subconsciously to us that we're unaware of it. For myself, I have hired a spiritual mentor or spiritual director for the next 8 months. I've never met this person. We did a Zoom call. He lives on the other side of the country on an island off of New Brunswick. And he said, "Well, I'd like you to read some books, Rick." And I said, "Oh, name the books." I said, "I got that book. I got that book. I got that book." He said, "Well, you know this stuff." And I thought, yeah, I know the stuff, but I'm not doing the stuff, right? There's a world of difference between head knowledge or cognitively knowing about something and putting it into practice. So the first book he wants me to read is The Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster, The Path to Spiritual Growth. Foster starts the book off by saying, "Superficiality is the curse of our age." Isn't that true? When did he write that? The mid-70s. How much more, even now so, right? That superficiality is the curse of our age. And I don't know about you, but I can easily be seduced by it. I can be more concerned about the U.S. Open than walking with the giants in the Bible. I can more follow, let's say, the characters in a Netflix series than the characters in the Scripture. To do the interior work at our soul level. So the question I have for you is, will that other thing, that idol, bring you lasting satisfaction? And if it won't, will you love God more? See, the question is not to love things, other things less. I don't have to love tennis less as much as I have to love God more. Tim Keller, in quoting Augustine, talks about disordered loves. And Augustine argued that we are shaped in our lives not so much by what we believe or what we think or even by what we do, but rather by what we love. You are what you love. And all sin is a lack of love. And our hearts have an order to their loves. And we can get into this disordered love state by loving things in the wrong order. Those things that ought to be important, we love less. And the things that ought to be less important, we end up loving more. And so our unhappiness comes from this disorder of loves. So there's nothing wrong with loving our work, but when loving our work is greater than loving our families, our love is out of order. Or if we love money, let's say more than justice, then we will treat others in an unjust way. And the ultimate order of love is the disorder of love is the failure to love God supremely, as Jesus said, to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. As Augustine said, our souls are restless until we find our rest in thee. Let me just read from Tim Keller. I like the way he words it. You harm yourself when you love anything more than God. How does this work? If you love your children more than you love God, you will essentially rest your need for significance and security in them. You will need too much for them to succeed, be happy, and love you. That will either drive them away or crush them under the weight of your expectations, because they will be the ultimate source of your happiness, and no human being can measure up to that. If instead you love your spouse or romantic partner more than God, the same thing occurs. If you love your work and career more than God, you will necessarily also love them more than your family, your community, and your own health. And so that will also lead to physical and relational breakdown. If you love anything more than God, you harm the object of your love. You harm yourself. You harm the world around you, and you end up deeply dissatisfied and discontent. Friends, our souls were made for God. Max Lucado, in one of his books, uses the metaphor. He says, think about a fish, and you had a fish, and you say, I want to make this fish happy. And so you take the fish, let's say, down to Crescent Beach, and you place it on the sand. You say, be happy, fish. Is the fish going to be happy there? No, it's not going to be happy. You say, oh, okay, I know what the fish needs. The fish needs a lawn chair. So you bring a lawn chair. You place the fish on the lawn chair, and you say, hey, be happy, fish. Is the fish happy? No, it's not going to be happy. You say, what does the fish need? It needs a drink. So you bring a little drink, you know, with a little umbrella. You place it beside the fish. You say, hey, fish, now you've got a beverage along with your lawn chair. Be happy. Is the fish going to be happy? No, the fish isn't going to be happy. You're like, why isn't the fish happy? Maybe he needs a big umbrella. It needs some shade. So you bring a big umbrella. Put it there, you know, try and get the fish to be happy. Is the fish going to be happy? No. You say, oh, maybe the fish needs something to read. Let me bring it a magazine, you know, Play Fish, you know. And so you bring the magazine to the fish, and it's got this magazine. Does that make the fish happy? No. Nothing is going to make the fish happy unless you throw it back in the water, because that's where the fish was designed to live. Friends, likewise, you and I, we are designed to live with our Creator, that our lives are to be in God. That's our natural state. And as we launch this fall series, I invite you to live that way. And you do that through the one who gave his life on the cross for you. Jesus said, I am the bread broken for you. We don't earn or achieve this life with God. We receive it by God's free grace. In a sense, on the cross, Jesus was cut off from God as he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was cut off from God. He received from God. He paid the debt that you and I owed. And paying the penalty for sin, he brings us back to God. In a sense, on the cross, he took a life without God so we can experience a life with God now. See, everything that Solomon pursued here, all of his pursuits, Jesus was tempted by also, but he resisted. And he went to the cross for you. In a sense, experiencing meaningless for that time period so you and I could experience meaning. So I invite you with this life with God this fall. Is there something that's holding you back? Some idol, something that you would pursue, thinking this will bring me happiness. Do you need to let that go today? and just have God as the source of your satisfaction. See, because everything else we're going to talk about in this series, if we don't get this first part right, the order of love, the rest isn't going to fit together. What do you need to let go of today? What idol do you need to renounce that you're trying to find your happiness in? And just find it in Him. Let's go to prayer. I'll just take a few moments of silent prayer. Is your love out of order? Are you pursuing the wrong thing to find that meaning, that happiness? You talk to God right now in the quietness of your heart. And as we start this fall, if your desire is to put something else behind, as heads are bowed and eyes are closed, to leave something out that you've been seeking satisfaction in, why don't you just put your hand up and look at me, and God will see that prayer that you want to leave something behind. Yeah. See that hand that you're saying, God, I want to love you supremely. Yeah. See, God sees your hand as you're putting it up, that you want to love God supremely, first and foremost, to love Him more than all. Oh, Heavenly Father, we were designed for life in You. We know this at our core. Our longing is for You. And I believe You're meeting with us today and in the days ahead, as we encounter You, the living God, we cry along with the psalmist, my soul thirsts for You. When can I meet with God? And thank You that You receive us. Thank You that You bring us a soul level satisfaction that nothing else in this world can bring. In Your name I pray, amen.